Popes. You still have the mic, Cheryl. There we go. Okay. That was so funny because Cheryl didn't get let go of the mic, and I guess somewhere in my mind I recognized that, but somewhere in my mind I didn't. So I was just sitting here waiting when she said, the mic is all yours. I was just sitting here doing nothing, and I thought, oh, wait, I'm supposed to take the mic. And I went, oh, wait, I can't. So like the part of me that was sitting here doing nothing knew exactly what it was doing. It couldn't do anything yet. But okay. Now I want to start with Anne's permission, just commenting a little bit on her teaching. First of all, I want to say that again, she may not realize it, but it's brilliant. The kind of teaching that she's doing, the honesty that she's sharing, the realizations that she's having about her own experience of confusion are brilliant. It's brilliant. I mean this, I'm not trying to give anybody a big head here, but it's brilliant to see that when the confusion is very heavy, that's not the time to be looking at your thoughts. Not everybody is able to see that on their own, and they get themselves tied up in a bigger knot, right? A bigger knot because they're trying to look at their thoughts at a time when they can't. I remember a message came to me once. I don't remember the name of the message, but the image of the message was standing in a river. And when the river is at a point of rapids, which is when the thoughts are just like wacko, right? When the river is at the point of rapids, what I saw, because I kind of saw a vision as I was writing the message. So what I saw was at that point, you just kind of reach up and grab a hold of there was a limb over my head. You just reach up and grab a hold of a limb and just hold steady. Just do your best to hold steady, to not get swept away with the rapids. You just stand there and hold on to that limb. Kind of like if you've seen little Buddha, Buddha's mother when she's giving birth to him, right? She holds on to a limb over her head. Same kind of thing. You just reach up, grab a hold of the limb, and just hold steady. And then what I saw in the image is when the river slows down, and when the river slowed down in the vision, there were these leaves, and the leaves represented thoughts. When the river slows down, then you can kind of pick up the leaves or pick up the thoughts and look at them. You know, and Anne expressed that clarity in her teaching. So, again, that kind of clarity is brilliant. So, Anne, just keep doing what you're doing. And, of course, you know, the ego's opinion of you is you suck. Don't expect it to change its mind, but you're doing a good job learning not to listen to it. what I want to do is start with a song. I picked one out. This is John Lennon, Watching the Wheels. And, of course, this song represents the witness perspective, right, just watching whatever is. So here we go, John Lennon.
People say I'm crazy. Shadows on the wall. Don't you miss the big time, boy, those on the run the ball. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round.
I love that song. It's one of my favorites. So last week, when we were looking at the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, the last question, question number four, the last question that we looked at was called, what is the state of beyond bliss? Question number three was, what is bliss? And then question number four was, what is the state beyond bliss? And I mentioned to you that if I could find it, I would bring something from Bernadette Roberts' writing, and we could look at this answer more in depth through her words, through her description. And I did find it. At least I think I did. Hopefully it's the right passage. So we'll do that. If I didn't find the right passage, then I suck, right, Anne? Here we go. I'm going to read first question number four again and the answer again, and then we'll go and look at Bernadette Roberts. I think one thing I want to say today is try not to think, just listen. Don't try to understand, just listen. You know, be like the earth absorbing the rain, right? The earth just is, and it lets the rain fall on it and be absorbed. Do that today. No thinking. All right, here's the question. What is the state beyond bliss? It is the state of unceasing peace of mind, which is found in the state of absolute quiet, or sleep with awareness there's a word here, jagrat susupti, which is a Sanskrit word, and that word means sleep with awareness. So the absolute quiet is being likened to sleep with awareness. What is the state of absolute bliss? It is the state of unceasing peace of mind, which is found in the state of absolute quiet, sleep with awareness, which resembles inactive deep sleep. In this state, in spite of the activity of the body and the senses. There is no external awareness. As in the case of a child immersed in sleep, who is not conscious of the food given to him by his mother. And you might, what I imagine anyway when I read this is I see a baby who's asleep and somehow is being put up to a mother's breast, and the baby begins to suckle on the breast without ever waking up, right? Just unconsciously begins to take the food. So in this state, in spite of the activity of the body and the senses, there is no external awareness, as in the case of a child immersed in sleep who is not conscious of the food given to him by his mother. A yogi who is in this state is inactive even while engaged in activity. This is also called the natural state of absorption in oneself without concepts. Again, that was the answer to the question, what is the state beyond bliss? And probably, you know, what stands out as very interesting to this, and again, something not to think about, because we couldn't think about it if we tried. What stands out as interesting about this is this state is the state of no external awareness. So the state of bliss is a joyous state, which still has external awareness. The state beyond bliss is also a joyous state, but there is no external awareness. So what I want to do now is read to you from Bernadette Roberts. I noticed some pond mud is in the room. And pond mud says, I hope this includes Jesus. Now, I don't know that you'll hear Jesus' name mentioned in this moment, but I want to tell you that the book I'm about to read from, was written by a woman who was raised as a Catholic and became a Carmelite nun. And so she was deeply involved in the contemplation of Jesus and had a spiritual awakening that is beyond all religion. And her name is Bernadette Roberts. This is her book, What is the Self? I am reading from... it says page 40, but gosh, I know it is page 40. It feels pretty thick for page 40, but there's many, many Roman numerals before you get to page 1. Okay, so I'm reading from page 40 of the book, What is the Self? The title of this particular section is called Ecstasy, the Vehicle of Crossing Over. And remember again, the question we're looking at is, what is beyond bliss? And the answer that was given was that there's no external awareness. So ecstasy, the vehicle of crossing over. One way to explain the change that takes place between the beginning and the end of the unitive state, and the unitive state would be what was being referred to here as the state of bliss. Remember, question 3 was about the state of bliss, and then question 4 was about beyond bliss. So bliss and the unitive state are the same state, right? So she says, one way to explain the change that takes place between the beginning and the end of the unitive state involves a discussion of the true nature of ecstasy, defined as the suspension of all consciousness from the unconscious to God conscious. So ecstasy is the suspension of all consciousness, no external awareness. Suspension means the temporary cessation of the reflexive mechanism, that's the part of the mind that allows you to be aware of yourself, and the fuel that propels it, the specific energy that propels awareness and allows you to be aware of yourself. Like right now, each and every one of you can be aware of yourself, right? During ecstasy, that is suspended. You have no awareness of yourself. And where there is no awareness of yourself, there is also no awareness of the world. Suspension means the temporary cessation of the reflexive mechanism and the fuel that propels it, along with all experiences to which consciousness or self gives rise. Again, if you have no awareness of yourself, you have no awareness of the world. Because ecstasy can be experienced at any stage of the journey, it is not indicative of any particular stage along the way. Yet, if we are familiar with this experience, we notice a change in the ecstatic state as the journey progresses. What changes is not the nature of the ecstasy or the suspension of consciousness, rather. What changes is the consciousness that is suspended. When only the barest rim of our consciousness remains, we can see that there is very little consciousness left to be suspended. In the egoic state, the cessation of consciousness is an overwhelmingly extraordinary experience. Whereas when only a fine line or the barest rim of consciousness remains, ecstasy is not too different from our present state. Thus, ecstasy is not such an extraordinary experience. The further along we are in the journey, the less unusual and the more prolonged the experience becomes, because we are better prepared to sustain it. So let me pause there. So what she is saying ecstasy, which Ramana Maharshi and the person he's speaking to are referring to as beyond bliss. Ecstasy is the suspension of all consciousness. Hindus tend to call this samadhi, right? Ecstasy is the suspension of all consciousness. And she says that when you first experience ecstasy, if you are very, very close to the ego state, you know, meaning the belief that you are a person and having all of the worries and concerns of a person, right? And you have an experience of ecstasy. It's like, wow, you know, wow, that was incredible, right? Sorry, Jamie, I didn't mean to scare you. I hope I didn't scare you guys like I just scared my dog. You know, but it's like, oh my God, because it's such a contrast, right, from the egoic state. But she says, as you progress on the journey and your egoic state falls away more and more and more, your idea of yourself as a self falls away more and more and more, the bliss of your everyday state and the bliss of ecstasy are not that different. Therefore, ecstasy is more normal. You know, so you might imagine yourself in an advanced spiritual state, where you're pretty much in bliss all the time. You feel to close your eyes. You close your eyes in what most people would call meditation. You drift into a state where there is no consciousness. You're in awareness without consciousness. You're in ecstasy, as she calls it. There's no awareness of self, no awareness of body, no awareness of world, only awareness of awareness. And then when that ends, you come back, and it feels more normal. It's not the, wow, you won't believe what happened to me, right? It's just more normal. And what she's also saying is as we advance, these periods of ecstasy, not only do they begin to feel more normal, more like our waking state, but also they become more prolonged. You may close your eyes and go into ecstasy for longer and longer periods. And if you've read any stories of Ramana Maharshi, you know he sat in periods of ecstasy for very, very long amounts of time. You know, in fact, when he was sitting in the temple, you know, there are stories that the bugs were even eating his bodily flesh. And he was so engrossed in ecstasy, or what they call samadhi, that he was completely unaware, because, again, he had no external consciousness. if I remember correctly, I even remember stories of people putting food in his mouth. And once they put the food in his mouth, he would chew and swallow. But again, he was like the baby suckling on a breast. He had no external awareness. So she, this Carmelite nun, actually here she's an ex-Carmelite nun, she's having these same types of experiences that Ramana Maharshi had. Look, I guess that's the wind. There's the strangest noise outside, but it must be the wind. I don't know what it was, but it went away. So let me continue reading. She says, if there is any problem with ecstasy, it arises from the fact that consciousness is so integrated with the senses that the suspension of consciousness also seems to be a suspension of the senses. Oh, I noticed Ponskam is asking, would one choose to do such a thing? I think, Ponskam, you know how you just wrote, praise God? I think that when a mystic, a Christian mystic or any other mystic, goes so deeply into the praise of God, this just happens. I don't know if you could actually call it a choice as much as it's just going so deeply into the love of God that this ecstasy just happens. I don't think you could ever make it happen. Right? You just go deep, deep, deep into the love of God. So she says, if there is any problem with ecstasy, it arises from the fact that consciousness is so integrated with the senses that the suspension of consciousness also seems to be a suspension of the senses, which it is not, of course. And one way that we know it's not is, again, people were able to put food in Ramana Maharshi's mouth, and when they put food in his mouth, he would chew and swallow. So just like a moment ago, maybe this happened on purpose, just like a moment ago when I wasn't consciously aware of the fact yet that Cheryl still had the mic, something in me was waiting. And then I'm like, what am I doing? I should be doing something, right? But something in me that was not the thinking mind was aware that I could not take the mic and therefore this body did not move. Right, so there's something else in us that is not that thinking mind that is able to recognize, oh, food has been placed in the mouth and chew and swallow, even when the thinking mind is completely suspended. So if there is any problem with ecstasy, it arises from the fact that consciousness is so integrated with the senses that the suspension of consciousness also seems to be a suspension of the senses, which it is not, of course. It is because of the integration of consciousness and the senses, however, that sustained or permanent ecstasy appears incompatible with continued earthly existence. Let me read that again. It is because of the integration of consciousness and the senses, however, that sustained or permanent ecstasy appears incompatible with continued earthly existence. After all, if both consciousness and the senses go down and stay down, we would verge on a condition of physical death or lapse into a purely vegetative state. So, again, from our point of view, where all we know is subject, object, consciousness, and a thinking mind and senses, it appears that this body needs a driver, right? It appears that in order for Regina to be here speaking, there has to be somebody thinking about what's to be said, right? And in order to go and cook dinner, there has to be somebody thinking about what's for dinner and how to prepare that food, right? We believe the body needs a driver. And without a driver, we believe the body would not move. As she says, either be close to death or be a vegetative state. So, again, it is because of the integration of consciousness and the senses, however, that sustained where permanent ecstasy appears incompatible with continued earthly existence. After all, if both consciousness and the senses go down and stay down, we would verge on a condition of physical death or lapse into a purely vegetative state. We read accounts of ecstatic mystics and contemplatives who have blacked out for periods of time and have no awareness of the world at all. What would become of them if they remained in this condition? Obviously, they would die because the senses have closed down along with consciousness. But if the senses could remain perfectly functional or awake during ecstasy, the world of ordinary life could go on as usual, only without self or consciousness, or using the language I used a minute ago, without a driver. The body would continue to move about, speak, do what the body does, but there would no longer be a driver. If the senses could remain perfectly functional or awake during ecstasy, the world of ordinary life could go on as usual, only without self or consciousness. So, perfect ecstasy is the ability of the senses to remain awake and perfectly functional in the absence of consciousness. If this can be done, or if some event makes it possible, life can go on without self or consciousness. Thus, one of the imperceptible changes that takes place between the beginning and the end of the unitive state is the increasing ability of the senses to stand alone and not be affected by any change in consciousness or any change in the self experience. Learning to ignore all the various movements of self or consciousness, which means not going along with them, getting caught up in them, and seeing them for what they are, is one of the automatic lessons we learn in the unitive state. So the unitive state, again, is what Ramana Maharshi and his questioner were referring to as the state of bliss. In A Course in Miracles, it is called the real world. Most people refer to it as, at least many people nowadays, refer to it as the state of being awake to consciousness. Okay, she says that basically this is another training period for a second awakening. You awaken to the unitive state, or you awaken to the real world, and you are in a state of joy or a state of bliss. But now you begin to have these experiences, these ecstasy experiences, where you lose all awareness of the body and the world. And what you learn through these experiences, and this would not be an intellectual learning by any stretch of the imagination, the intellect could never do this, but what you learn through these ecstasy experiences is you learn to, I don't know how to say this because there's no you there, but I'll just use words because the words suck. I'll try and say it again in another way in a second. You learn to allow the body to continue to move about and do what it does without a person or a self that has any external subject-object awareness. Another way to say this is in the reverse order. Let's start with the absolute. And the absolute, in some way, manifests into consciousness. Consciousness being the essence that is necessary in order to create form. Right? And then consciousness naturally begins to evolve into different types of form. And eventually that evolution includes humans. And what happens somehow is that consciousness begins to identify with the idea, I am human, I am a person. And consciousness, mistaking itself for the person, then begins to identify with the thinking self, with I need to see in order to walk, I need to feel in order to cook or work with tools, and all of this thought gets conditioned into the brain. So now we're moving in a reverse order. Just as consciousness learned to think it needed the senses in order to drive the body, we're now moving in a reverse order where consciousness is disidentifying with the body and the senses, and it's pulling away from that identification and learning to abide as itself, pure consciousness. And the body is moved just through, through interdependent co-arising, but the body is moved through the script. If you're using the language of A Course in Miracles, the body is moved through the script, through the playing out of the world. But it doesn't need a driver. It doesn't need consciousness thinking it's a self in order to move the body. The body moves on its own. But consciousness has to relearn this. The person doesn't have to learn this. The thinking mind doesn't have to learn this. They're what's abandoned. But consciousness has to relearn this. The consciousness that identified with the body and the mind is now de-identifying and coming back to being itself. So let me read this last paragraph again. Thus, one of the imperceptible changes that takes place between the beginning and end of the unitive state is the increasing ability of the senses to stand alone and not be affected by any change in consciousness or any change in self-experience. So consciousness could slip into samadhi, and the body continues to move. It's learning to do that. It's learning to not believe it needs a driver. Learning to ignore all the various movements of self or consciousness, which means not going along with them, getting caught up in them, and seeing them for what they are, is one of the automatic lessons we learn in the unitive state. Authentic ecstasy is not something we can bring about by our own efforts, right? This is all, just like you didn't bring about through your own effort learning to, crawl, for example, right? It's always amazing to watch babies learn to crawl. Nature leads them to learn to crawl, right? They don't go to crawling school. Same thing here. The nature of awakening leads this process of withdrawing consciousness identification with the body and the senses. Authentic ecstasy is not something we can bring about by our own efforts. The unconscious reflexive mechanism is not under conscious control. Now, when she talks about the reflexive mechanism, she's talking about your ability to know yourself. Like right now, every one of you have the ability to know yourself, not only your true self, but your false self, right? Anne was teaching just before me, and she talked about how she had these periods of confusion. How does she know that she had confusion? That's the reflexive mechanism. It's being able to be aware of yourself. Therefore, you're aware when you're in confusion. You're aware when you're happy. You're aware when you're sleepy, right? So she says this reflexive mechanism, which makes us aware of ourselves, isn't under conscious control. And if you think about that, that's true. For example, I can consciously make a decision now to snap my fingers, right? But I'm naturally aware of the fact that I'm snapping my fingers. I'm not saying, okay, now pay attention and notice that you are snapping your fingers. Because that ability to be aware of myself is natural. It's not under conscious control. The snapping of my fingers may be under conscious control, but the awareness that I'm doing it is natural. It's not under conscious control. I am naturally aware of myself. And if I am naturally aware of myself, then it's then I can't make myself not be aware. Which means I cannot put myself in ecstasy, which has no awareness, no subject-object awareness, right? Since I'm not the one that's making me be aware of myself, I can't make myself not be aware. I don't have that kind of control. So authentic ecstasy is not something we can bring about by our own efforts. The unconscious reflexive mechanism is not under conscious control. Rather, it is beyond all the efforts and movements of the phenomenal self. While the energies, feelings, thoughts, and reflections of the phenomenal self may not be problematic in the unitive state, they are nevertheless movements of self or consciousness. So, for example, prior to the unitive state, I may feel guilt or anger and get all caught up in it, like, oh, you know, have a storm. After I wake up to the unitive state, there may be a little blip of guilt or anger that flips through, but I no longer get caught up in it. I'm just the witness of it, right? But she's saying that with ecstasy, there is no self and no consciousness at all, which means there would be no awareness of guilt, anger, or anything else. So ego state, I see those movements in consciousness, I identify with them, they're a problem. Unitive state, if those movements in consciousness occur, I see them, but I do not identify with them, they're not a problem, right? Beyond the unitive state, beyond bliss, I'm totally unaware of such movements. Let me start again with this paragraph. The unconscious reflexive mechanism is not under conscious control. Rather, it is beyond all the efforts and movements of the phenomenal self. While the energies, feelings, thoughts, and reflections of the phenomenal self may not be problematic in the unitive state, they are, nevertheless, movements of self or consciousness. Ecstasy is a more perfect condition than the unitive state because there is no self or consciousness in it, hence, no possibility of any movement and no possibility of self-awareness. Once we see that all movement of self arises from the true unconscious self and not from the divine ground, we have come a ways in the unitive stage. So in other words, when we see that all movements of self actually still come from the ego and not from the true self, right? We've woken up, you know, so we've woken up to a pretty strong degree. So you'll sometimes hear people who have had an awakening say, well, I still get angry. Well, she's saying that, you know, at the beginning of the unitive state, it's pretty normal to say that. But as you move further along and you have less and less identification with the phenomenal self, you see that the true self never gets angry, right? You see that. So there's a shift. There's a continual shift that's happening, which really explains why different people who feel they've awakened still to describe to us different experiences. Because you could say they're in the unitive state. They're not in the beyond bliss state. They're in the unitive state. And the unitive state is another schoolhouse. So they are in different degrees of this second awakening. And therefore they have different experiences. Right? Once we see that all movement of self arises from the unconscious self and not from the divine ground, we have come a ways in the unitive stage. With this realization, pure sensory perception becomes increasingly important and trustworthy. Also, ecstasy or the suspension of consciousness becomes increasingly more perfect, more natural, and everyday, though not permanent. So the path that lies ahead once we come to the unitive state will ultimately bring about the separation of these two different systems, namely consciousness and the senses. I'll read that again. So the path that lies ahead, once we come to the unitive state, once we awaken to what the Course would call the real world, the path that lies ahead, once we come to the unitive state, will ultimately bring about the separation of these two different systems, namely consciousness and the senses. So consciousness withdraws from its identification with the body, with its belief that it has to drive the body. The purpose of this separation is to enable the senses to remain awake and functional once the system of consciousness has fallen away. Now, again, I told you not to think about this because we can't think about it. But imagine eyes that still see, you know, a mouth that still speaks, a body that still moves, but there is no longer a driver. It's being moved by the script, not by a self. Whether it is recognized or not, ecstasy is the immediate vehicle or condition that ultimately moves over the line or goes beyond the boundaries of consciousness. So ecstasy is the training vehicle. Obviously, self or consciousness does not move over the line or go beyond the boundaries of self or consciousness. Until the senses have become fairly independent of consciousness, there can be no permanent suspension of consciousness or crossing over. Until the preparation is right, ecstasy keeps returning to the self or consciousness. Ecstasy is a training ground. Until the preparation is right, ecstasy keeps returning to self or consciousness. We might add that for some people, ecstasy has never suspended the senses or made them totally inoperable. For others, however, it seems the senses are greatly affected and made inoperable by the suspension of consciousness. In other words, some people experience ecstasy and keep right on walking. Other people have to sit down and close their eyes when ecstasy hits. I do not know why this is so, but from the literature, it seems that for the visionaries, the senses are more greatly affected by ecstasy. But whatever the case, ecstasy might be used as a gauge of our journey from beginning to end. The gauge is the increasing ability to bear the vision, as it were, without the senses going down or without everyday life and its normal behaviors coming to a standstill. The goal, then, is to keep the senses awake and able to respond even though consciousness or self has been suspended or it has ceased to function. And what this really reminds me of is that discussion with Nisargadatta Maharaj and a questioner. When Nisargadatta Maharaj is explaining the same thing, how he is not aware of a world, right? He is not aware. In fact, he says, I am distinctly aware of not having a body, right? He doesn't feel that he has a body. He is consciousness. And the one questioning him says, but I see you sitting there smoking. You know, like from our point of view, we cannot understand because we believe the body needs a driver. If you're sitting there smoking a cigarette, looking right at me and talking to me, there must be a driver there, right? There must be a person smoking. There must be a person speaking. And what Ramana Maharshi is saying is that is not true. The person smokes and the person speaks without any external awareness, just like the baby can suckle a breast without any external awareness. And what she's doing in the best that she can, which I think this is the best I've ever read, is she's explaining how this process of consciousness withdrawing from the body, but yet the body being able to continue without consciousness, how this process is learned in the unitive state or the real world or the middle awakening. through increasing experiences of ecstasy or increasing experiences of this happening on a temporary basis so that consciousness can learn to trust it more and more and more and let go of its attachment to the body. She continues, as already said, when we come to the point of perfect ecstasy, there will no longer be a significant gap between the ecstatic state and our ordinary, everyday, unitive consciousness. This means that the final dissolution of the fine line between the two, the unitive state and ecstasy, falls away without notice. This dissolution becomes noticeable when the usual return to the unitive consciousness does not occur. Because again, what's been happening during this training period is that you go into ecstasy or samadhi, and there's no awareness of a body, no awareness of a world, but then you come back and you seem to be the driver of the body again. And then you go into ecstasy or samadhi, and then you come back. Right? Well, she says, the way that you really know this process is over is there comes a time that you go into ecstasy or samadhi, or you go into awareness of awareness only, and you never come back. And that's how you, she says, that's how you know this process has completed itself. The final dissolution of the fine line between the unitive state and ecstasy falls away without notice. This dissolution becomes noticeable when the usual return to the unitive consciousness does not occur. Because we have no way of knowing ahead of time what lies beyond this line or what the permanency of such a state of existence would be like, there may be an initial movement of fear at the idea of crossing over and never again returning. But what eventually casts out all fear is a lifetime spent with the divine, a lifetime of being finely attuned to its ways and doings, and years of testing self's absolute, immovable trust in the divine. An entire life's journey of love and trust is now brought to bear on the single unknown moment of permanently crossing the line. The enormous preparation and variety of experiences needed to come to this moment can now be sufficiently stressed. So there she's talking about that final awakening, right? We have the prior awakening, awakening to consciousness or awakening to the real world, which is actually just awakening to another schoolhouse, another training period. And then we have the second awakening, which is awakening to the absolute. In A Course in Miracles, the two awakenings are called, first you awaken to the real world, and then you awaken to heaven, right? Or you awaken to true perception, and then you awaken to knowledge, right? This is the experience that she had that she's describing. And notice, you know, the one that is writing this book, think about it, the one that is writing the book and describing it is really no longer there. Although I said, think about it, don't think about it because you can't. But we know that she is describing the experience that A Course in Miracles teaches, that Ramana Maharshi describes. Even though we can't imagine this, we know there's a consistency in what we are being told by A Course in Miracles, by Ramana Maharshi, by Nisargadatta Maharaj, and by this nun, Bernadette Roberts. She continues, what is meant by the fine line between two different dimensions of existence is the difference between a temporary suspension of consciousness and an irreversible permanent suspension, which is the end of all ecstasy, because ecstasy was a training ground, and the beginning of the no-self dimension. In other words, as long as ecstasy is a transient experience, there is always a return to the unitive state. But the moment there is a permanent suspension of self or consciousness, there can be no return. Instead, there begins the adjustment to a totally new dimension of existence, and one that could not have been imagined ahead of time. Ecstasy does not define the new dimension of existence or the no-self condition. Rather, ecstasy is only the vehicle or the condition of crossing over to a new dimension of existence. Prior to this moment, ecstasy, as it was experienced during the passage, was only the gauge of readiness for the eventual passing over to a hitherto unknown line, a line we are not aware of until we are on top of it. So again, ecstasy is more like the boat that you use to cross from one shore to the other. The other shore is unimaginable. And there's no way to know what that other shore is until you arrive. And again, that's what the Course would call heaven or knowledge. And that's what Ramana Maharshi is referring to as beyond bliss, this other shore. The moment consciousness is permanently, irreversibly suspended with no possibility of return is a moment unknown to consciousness. So this is the awakening beyond consciousness, right? If you know my four principles of God, the first principle is what I call life awareness. The second principle is consciousness. So this is awakening beyond consciousness. So first there's an awakening beyond ego to consciousness. Now there's an awakening beyond consciousness to the absolute. The moment consciousness is permanently, irreversibly suspended with no possibility of return is a moment unknown to consciousness. Thus, the moment of passing over is totally unknown. It is not an experience. Once on the other side, we can no longer speak of ecstasy. There is no ecstasy anymore because there is no consciousness to be suspended. Here begins a totally new dimension of existence, one that bears no comparison to the ecstatic experience. We should also add that no one, no entity or being, no self or consciousness passes over the line. Passing over simply means that all experiences of self or consciousness have permanently ceased. On the other side, nothing remains that could possibly be called self or consciousness. Do you see why I said don't think about this? Just listen. She continues. One final point. As noted earlier, when we first came to the unitive state, we had glimpses or experiences of yet a further, more final state. Heavenly, or whatever we might designate as the ultimate divine condition. At that time, however, we regarded this final condition as incompatible with continued earthly life. And many people believe this. You hear people say, if there's still a body, then there can't be an awakening, right? She says, this is the belief. This is the belief. We believe this final condition is incompatible with a continued earthly life. But once beyond the fine line, the former divine condition becomes possible this side of the grave without death. The reason for this is that over a long period of time, the dependency of consciousness on the senses decreases until finally, when we come to the fine line, the senses are not appreciably affected when consciousness is suspended. This means there comes a point in the journey when the senses can remain perfectly functional and can go right on without consciousness or self. Thus, the distance traversed between the beginning and the end of the unitive state entails an increasing separation between the senses and consciousness, all of which, of course, is a preparation for eventually living in a state wherein there is no self or no consciousness. Now, having read all of that, let me just read this question and answer one more time, and then we'll just have to leave it as it is, because again, it's not something we can actually understand. but we can hear it. And as we begin to have these experiences ourselves, we can know that there are others who have gone before us, right? And therefore, hopefully that will help eliminate the fear. Because she talks about how fear will arise when you think about crossing over and never coming back. When you think about crossing over and never coming back, right? So if we know others have gone before us, then hopefully that will help reduce the fear for us when these awakening experiences begin happening to us. So again, here was the question that we were looking at. What is the state beyond bliss? It is the state of unceasing peace of mind, which is found in the state of absolute quiet or sleep with awareness, which resembles inactive deep sleep. And when he says sleep with awareness, what he's really referring to is no consciousness anymore, right? No consciousness. It is the state of unceasing peace of mind, which is found in the state of absolute quiet, which resembles inactive deep sleep. In this state, in spite of the activity of the body and the senses, there is no external awareness. Again, in this state, in spite of the activity of the body and the senses, there is no external awareness. As in the case of a child immersed in sleep who is not conscious of the food given to him by his mother. A yogi who is in this state is inactive even while engaged in activity. This is also called the natural state of absorption in oneself without concepts. So I think that is, at least in my humble opinion, the very best description I've heard of awakening beyond subject-object consciousness ever, right? Ever. There are sometimes people who will say the real world and heaven is the same thing. They are absolutely mistaken. Mistaken only because they can't imagine anything beyond the real world. We can't imagine anything beyond perfect happiness as consciousness. Right? Therefore, because we can't imagine anything beyond perfect happiness of consciousness, people say, that's it. That's the end of the road. And what these teachers are telling us, and what even A Course in Miracles is telling us, is that is not the end of the road. All right. That's it for me today. Next week we'll go on to question number 5. Thanks, y'all, for being here to listen to something that none of us can actually understand. Bye.